movies, sleepovers, summer classes in Central Park, and map and compass skills. I'm still not quite sure why his name was the first to fall out of my mouth, since we weren't such good friends anymore. We'd drifted apart at the start of junior high. I'd hardly seen him in months.
Barber with a U?
Said Enrique as he wrote the name down.
Who are these people? Friends?
Yes, I replied. I'd known them all my life, practically. The Barbers lived on Park Avenue. Andy had been my best friend since third grade.
His dad has a big job on Wall Street, I said,
and then I shut up. It had just occurred to me that Andy's dad had spent some unknown amount of time in a Connecticut mental hospital for exhaustion.
What about the mother?
She and my mom are good friends.
Almost true, but not quite. Though they were on perfectly friendly terms, my mother wasn't nearly rich or connected enough for a social pages lady like Mrs. Barber.
No, I mean, what does she do for a living?
Charity work,
I said, after a disoriented pause.
Like the antique show at the Armory?
So she's a stay-at-home mom?
I nodded, glad she'd supplied the phrase so handily, which, though technically true, was not how anyone who knew Mrs. Barber would ever think to describe her. Enrique signed his name with a flourish.
We look into it. Can't promise anything,
he said, clicking his pen and sticking it back in his pocket.
We can certainly drop you over with these folks for the next few hours, though, if they're who you want to be with.
He slid out of the booth and walked outside. Through the front window, I could see him walking back and forth on the sidewalk, talking on the phone with a finger in one ear. Then he dialed another number for a much shorter call. There was a quick stop at the apartment, less than 5 minutes, just long enough for me to grab my school bag and a few impulsive and ill-considered articles of clothing. And then, back in their car again, in the back seat.
Are you buckled up back there?
I leaned with my cheek to the cold glass and watched the lights go green all up the empty Dawn Canyon of Park Avenue. Andy lived in the upper 60s, in one of the great old white-glove buildings on Park, where the lobby was straight from a Dick Powell movie, and the doormen were still mostly Irish. They'd all been there forever, and as it happened, I remembered the guy who met us at the door, Kenneth, the midnight man. He was younger than most of the other doormen, dead pale and poorly shaven, often a bit slow on the draw from working nights. Though he was a likable guy, had sometimes mended soccer balls for Andy and me, and dispensed friendly advice on how to deal with bullies at school, he was known around the building for having a bit of a drinking problem. And as he stepped aside to usher us in through the grand doors, and gave me the first of the many, "God, kid, I'm so sorry," looks I would be receiving over the next months, I smelled the sourness of beer and sleep on him.
"They're expecting you," he said to the social workers. "Go on up."
2. It was Mr. Barber who opened the door, first a crack, then all the way.
"Morning, morning," he said, stepping back.
Mr. Barber was a tiny bit strange-looking, with something pale and silvery about him, as if his treatments in the Connecticut Ding Farm, as he called it, had rendered him incandescent. His eyes were a queer, unstable gray, and his hair was pure white, which made him seem older than he was until you noticed that his face was young and pink, boyish even. His ruddy cheeks and his long, old-fashioned nose, in combination with the prematurely white hair, gave him the amiable look of a lesser founding father, some minor member of the Continental Congress, teleported to the 21st century. He was wearing what appeared to be yesterday's office clothes, a rumpled dress shirt, and expensive-looking suit trousers that looked like he had just grabbed them off the bedroom floor.
"Come on in,"
he said briskly, rubbing his eyes with his fist.
"Hello there, dear,"
he said to me. The dear, startling, from him, even in my disoriented state. Barefoot, he padded ahead of us through the marble foyer. Beyond, in the richly decorated living room, all glazed chintz and Chinese jars, it felt less like morning than midnight. Silk-shaded lamps burning low, big dark paintings of naval battles and drapes drawn against the sun. There, by the baby grand, and a flower arrangement the size of a packing case, stood Mrs. Barber, in a floor-sweeping housecoat, pouring coffee into cups on a silver tray. As she turned to greet us, I could feel the social workers taking in the apartment, and her. Mrs. Barber was from a society family with an old Dutch name, so cool and blonde and monotone that sometimes she seemed partially drained of blood. She was a masterpiece of composure. Nothing ever ruffled her or made her upset, and though she was not beautiful, her calmness had the magnetic pull of beauty, a stillness so powerful that the molecules realigned themselves around her when she came into a room. Like a fashion drawing come to life, she turned heads wherever she went, gliding along obliviously without appearing to notice the turbulence she created in her wake. Her eyes were spaced far apart, her ears were small, high set, and very close to her head, and her body was long-waisted and thin, like an elegant weasel's. Andy had these features as well, but in ungainly proportions, without her slinky, ermine grace. In the past, her reserve, or coldness, depending how you saw it, had sometimes made me uncomfortable. But that morning, I was grateful for her sang-froid.
"Hi there. We'll be putting you in the room with Andy," she said to me, without beating around the bush. "I'm afraid he's not up for school yet, though. If you'd like to lie down for a while, you're perfectly welcome to go to Platt's room."
Platt was Andy's older brother, away at school.
"You know where it is, of course."
I said that I did.
"Are you hungry?"
"No."
"Well then, tell us what we can do for you."
I was aware of them all looking at me. My headache was bigger than anything else in the room. In the bull's-eye mirror above Mrs. Barber's head, I could see the whole scene replicated in freakish miniature. Chinese jars, coffee tray, awkward-looking social workers and all. In the end, it was Mr. Barber who broke the spell.
"Come along, then. Let's get you squared away,"
he said, clapping his hand on my shoulder and firmly steering me out of the room.
"No, back here. This way. Aft. Right back here."
The only time I'd ever set foot in Platt's room, several years before, Platt, who was a champion lacrosse player and a bit of a psychopath, had threatened to beat the ever-living crap out of Andy and me. When he'd lived at home, he'd stayed in there all the time with the door locked, and, Andy told me, smoked pot. Now all his posters were gone and the room was very clean and empty-looking, since he was away at Groton. There were free weights, stacks of old National Geographics, an empty aquarium. Mr. Barber, opening and closing drawers, was babbling a bit.
"Let's see what's in here, shall we? Bed sheets. And more bed sheets. I'm afraid I never come in here. I do hope you'll forgive me. Ah! Swimming trunks. Won't be needing those this morning, will we?"
Scrabbling around in yet a third drawer, he finally produced some new pajamas with the tags still on. Ugly as hell. Reindeer on electric blue flannel. No mystery why they'd never been worn.
"Well then,"
he said, running a hand through his hair and cutting his eyes anxiously towards the door.
"I'll leave you now. Hell of a thing that's happened. Good Lord. You must be feeling awfully rough. A good solid sleep will be the best thing in the world for you. Are you tired?"
he said, looking at me closely. Was I? I was wide awake, and yet part of me was so glassed off and numb I was practically in a coma.
"If you'd rather have company, perhaps if I build a fire in the other room? Tell me what you want."
At this question, I felt a sharp rush of despair, for as bad as I felt, there was nothing he could do for me. And from his face, I realized he knew that too.
"We're only in the next room if you need us. That is to say, I'll be leaving soon for work, but someone will be here."
His pale gaze darted around the room and then returned to me.
"Perhaps it's incorrect of me, but in the circumstances, I wouldn't see the harm in pouring you what my father used to call a minor nip, if you should happen to want such a thing. Which, of course, you don't,"
he added hastily, noting my confusion.
"Quite unsuitable. Never mind."
He stepped closer, and for an uncomfortable moment I thought he might touch me or hug me. But instead, he clapped his hands and rubbed them together.
"In any case, we're perfectly happy to have you. And I hope you'll make yourself as comfortable as you can. You'll speak right up if you need anything, won't you?"
He had hardly stepped out when there was whispering outside the door. Then a knock.
"Someone here to see you,"
Mrs. Barber said. and withdrew. And in plodded Andy, blinking, fumbling with his glasses. It was clear that they had woken him up and hauled him out of bed. With a noisy creak of bedsprings, he sat beside me on the edge of Platt's bed, looking not at me, but at the wall opposite. He cleared his throat, pushed his glasses up on the bridge of his nose. There followed a long silence. Urgently, the radiator clanked and hissed. Both his parents had gotten out of there so fast it was like they'd heard the fire alarm.
"Wow,"
he said, after some moments in his eerie, flat voice.
"Disturbing."
"Yeah," I said. And together we sat in silence, side by side, staring at the dark green walls of Platt's room and the taped squares where his posters had once been. What else was there to say? 3. Even now, to remember that time fills me with a choking, hopeless sensation. Everything was terrible. People offered me cold drinks, extra sweaters, food I couldn't eat, bananas, cupcakes, club sandwiches, ice cream. I said yes and no when I was spoken to, and spent a lot of time staring at the carpet so people wouldn't see I'd been crying. Though the barber's apartment was enormous by New York standards, it was on a low floor and practically lightless, even on the Park Avenue side. Though it was never quite night there, or exactly day, still the glow of lamplight against burnished oak gave off an air of conviviality and safety, like a private club. Friends of Platt's called it the Creepatorium, and my father, who'd come there once or twice to pick me up after sleepovers, had referred to it as Frank E. Campbell's after the funeral home. But I found a solace in the massive, opulent pre-war gloom, which was easy to retreat into if you didn't feel like talking or being stared at. People stopped by to see me, my social workers, of course, and a pro bono psychiatrist who'd been referred to me by the city, but also people from my mother's work, some of whom, like Mathilde, I'd been expert at imitating in order to make her laugh, and loads of friends from NYU and her fashion days. A semi-famous actor named Jed, who sometimes spent Thanksgiving with us. Your mother was the queen of the universe as far as I was concerned, and a slightly punked out woman in an orange coat named Kika, who told me how she and my mother, dead broke in the East Village, had thrown a wildly successful dinner party for 12 people for less than $20, featuring, among other things, cream and sugar packets lifted from a coffee bar and herbs picked surreptitiously from a neighbor's window box. Annette, a fireman's widow in her 70s, my mother's former neighbor down on the Lower East Side, showed up with a box of cookies from the Italian bakery around where she and my mother used to live, the same butter cookies with pine nuts she always brought us when she visited at Sutton Place. Then there was Cinzia, our old housekeeper, who burst into tears when she saw me and asked me for a picture of my mother to keep in her wallet. Mrs. Barber broke up these visits if they dragged on too long, on the grounds that I got tired easily, but also, I suspect, because she couldn't handle people like Cinzia and Kika monopolizing her living room for indefinite periods of time. After 45 minutes or so, she would come and stand quietly in the door, and if they didn't take the hint, she would speak up and thank them for coming, perfectly polite, but in such a way that people realized that the time was getting on and rose to their feet. Her voice, like Andy's, was hollow and infinitely far away. Even when she was standing right next to you, she sounded as if she was relaying transmissions from Alpha Centauri. Around me, over my head, the life of the household went on. Every day, the doorbell rang many times. Housekeepers, nannies, caterers, tutors, the piano instructor, school friends of Andy's younger siblings, social pages ladies and tassel loafer business guys connected with Mrs. Barber's charities. Often in the afternoons, perfume-smelling women with shopping bags dropped by for coffee and tea. In the evenings, couples dressed for dinner congregated over wine and fizzy water in the living room, where the flower arrangements were delivered every week from a swanky Madison Avenue florist, and the newest issues of Architectural Digest and The New Yorker were fanned just so on the coffee table. If Mr. and Mrs. Barber were terribly inconvenienced to have an extra kid dumped on them at scarcely a moment's notice, they were graceful enough not to show it. Andy's mother, with her understated jewelry and her not-quite-interested smile, the kind of woman who could get on the phone with the mayor if she needed a favor, seemed to operate somehow above the constraints of New York City bureaucracy. Even in my confusion and grief, I had a sense that she was managing things behind the scenes, making it all easier for me, shielding me from the rougher aspects of the social services machinery, and I'm now fairly sure, the press. Calls were forwarded from the insistently ringing telephone directly to her cell phone. There were conversations in low voices, instructions to the doormen. After coming in on one of Enrique's many tireless interrogations about my father's whereabouts, interrogations that often brought me close to tears, he might as well have been grilling me about the location of missile sites in Pakistan. She sent me out of the room, and then in a controlled monotone put a stop to it.
Well, I mean, obviously the boy doesn't know where he is. The mother didn't know either. Yes, I know you'd like to find him, but clearly the man doesn't want to be found. He's taken measures not to be found. He wasn't paying child support. He left a lot of debts. He more or less flew town without a word, so frankly, I'm not quite sure what you mean to accomplish by contacting this stellar parent and fine citizen. And yes, yes, all well and good, but if the man's creditors can't run him down, and your agency can't either, then I'm not sure what's to be gained from continuing to badger the child. Are you? Can we agree to put a stop to this?
Certain elements of the martial law imposed since my arrival had inconvenienced the household. No longer, for instance, were the housemaids permitted to listen to 1010 Winds, the news station, while they worked.
No, no,
said Etta the cook, with a warning glance at me when one of the cleaners tried to turn the radio on, and in the mornings the Times was taken immediately to Mr. Barber and not left out for the rest of the family to read. Clearly, this was not the usual custom.
Somebody's carried the paper off again,
Andy's little sister Kitsy would wail before falling into guilty silence after a look from her mother, and I soon gathered that the newspaper had begun vanishing into Mr. Barber's study because there were things in it that it was thought preferable for me not to see. Thankfully, Andy, who had been my companion in adversity before, understood that the last thing I wanted was to talk. Those first few days, they let him stay home from school with me. In his musty plaid room with the bunk beds, where I had spent many a Saturday night in elementary school, we sat over the chessboard, Andy playing for both of us, since in my fog I scarcely remembered how to move the pieces.
Okay,
he said, pushing his glasses up on the bridge of his nose.
Right. Are you absolutely sure you want to do that?
Do what?
Yes, I see,
said Andy, in the wispy, irritating voice which had driven so many bullies to shove him to the sidewalk out in front of our school over the years.
Your rook is in danger. That's perfectly correct, but I would suggest you take a closer look at your queen. No, no, your queen. D5.
He had to say my name to get my attention. Over and over I was reliving the moment where my mother and I had run up the museum steps. Her striped umbrella. Rain peppering and driving in our faces. What had happened, I knew, was irrevocable. Yet at the same time, it seemed there had to be some way I could go back to the rainy street and make it all happen differently.
The other day, said Andy, somebody, I really believe it was Malcolm, what's his name, or some other supposedly respected writer. Anyway, he made a big production the other day in the Science Times of pointing out that there are more potential games of chess than there are grains of sand in the entire world. It's ridiculous that a science writer for a major newspaper would feel compelled to belabor a fact so obvious.
Right, I said, returning with efforts from my thoughts.
Like, who doesn't know that grains of sand on the planet, however numerous, are finite? It's absurd that someone would even comment on such a non-issue, you know, like, breaking news story, just throwing it out there, you know, as a supposedly arcane fact.
Andy and I, in elementary school, had become friends under more or less traumatic circumstances, after we'd been skipped ahead a grade because of high test scores. Everyone now appeared to agree that this had been a mistake for both of us, though for different reasons. That year, bumbling around among boys all older and bigger than us, Boys who tripped us and shoved us and slammed locker doors on our hands, who tore up our homework and spat in our milk, who called us maggot and faggot and dickhead. Sadly, a natural for me with a last name like Decker. During that whole year, our Babylonian captivity, Andy called it in his faint, glum voice, we'd struggled along side by side like a pair of weakling ants under a magnifying glass, shin-kicked, sucker-punched, ostracized, eating lunch huddled in the most out-of-the-way corner we could find in order to keep from getting ketchup packets and chicken nuggets thrown at us. For almost 2 years, he had been my only friend, and vice versa. It depressed and embarrassed me to remember that time. Our Autobot wars and Lego spaceships, the secret identities we'd assumed from classic Star Trek. I was Kirk, he was Spock, in an effort to make a game of our torments.
Captain, it would appear that these aliens are holding us captive in some simulacrum of your schools for human children on Earth.
Before I'd been tossed in with a tight, competitive bunch of older boys, with a label reading Gifted tied around my neck, I'd never been especially reviled or humiliated at school. But poor Andy, even before he was skipped ahead a grade, had always been a chronically picked-upon kid. Scrawny, twitchy, lactose intolerant, with skin so pale it was almost transparent, and a penchant for throwing out words like noxious and phonic in casual conversation. As bright as he was clumsy. His flat voice, his habit of breathing through his mouth due to a chronically blocked nose, gave him the appearance of being mildly stupid instead of excessively smart. Among the rest of his kittenish, sharp-toothed, athletic siblings, racing around between their friends and their sports teams and their rewarding after-school programs, he stood out like a random pastehead who had wandered out onto the lacrosse field by mistake. Whereas I'd managed to recover somewhat from the catastrophe of fifth grade, Andy had not. He stayed home on Friday and Saturday nights. He never got invited to parties or to hang out in the park. As far as I knew, I was still his only friend. And though thanks to his mother, he had all the right clothes and dressed like the popular kids, even wore contact lenses some of the time, no one was fooled. Hostile jock types, who remembered him from the bad old days, still pushed him around and called him 3PO for his long-ago mistake of wearing a Star Wars shirt to school. Andy had never been overly talkative, even in childhood, except in occasional pressured bursts. Much of our friendship had consisted of wordlessly passing comic books back and forth. Years of harassment at school had rendered him even more close-tongued and uncommunicative, less apt to employ Lovecraftian vocabulary words, more prone to entomb himself in advanced placement math and science. Math had never interested me much. I was what they called a high verbal. But while I'd fallen short of my early academic promise in every area, and had no interest in good grades if I had to work for them, Andy was in AP everything and at the very top of our class. Certainly he would have been sent off to Groton like Platt, a prospect that had terrified him as far back as third grade, had not his parents worried with some justification about sending away to school a son so persecuted by his classmates that he had once been nearly suffocated at recess by a plastic bag thrown over his head. And there were other worries as well. The reason I knew about Mr. Barber's time in the Ding Farm was because Andy had told me, in his matter-of-fact way, that his parents were afraid he might have inherited something of the same vulnerability, as he put it. During his time home from school with me, Andy apologized for having to study.
"But unfortunately, it's necessary," he said, sniffling and wiping his nose on his sleeve.
His course load was incredibly demanding.
AP hell on wheels.
And he couldn't afford to fall even a day behind. While he labored over what seemed endless amounts of schoolwork, chem and calculus, American history, English, astronomy, Japanese, I sat on the floor with my back against the side of his dresser, counting silently to myself. This time, only 3 days ago, she was alive. This time, 4 days. A week. In my mind, I went over all the meals we'd eaten in the days leading up to her death. Our last visit to the Greek diner. Our last visit to Shun Li Palace. The last dinner she'd cooked for me. spaghetti carbonara, and the last dinner before that, a dish called chicken indienne, which she'd learned to make from her mother back in Kansas. Sometimes, to look occupied, I turned through old volumes of Full Metal Alchemist or an illustrated H.G. Wells he had in his room, but even the pictures were more than I could absorb. Mostly, I stared out at the pigeons flapping on the window ledge as Andy filled out endless grids in his hiragana workbook, his knee bouncing onto the desk as he worked. Andy's room, originally one large bedroom that the barbers had divided in half, faced Park Avenue. Horns cried in the crosswalk at rush hour, and the light burned gold in the windows across the street, dying down around the same time as the traffic began to thin. As the night wore on, phosphorescent in the street lamps, violet city midnights that never quite faded to black, I turned from side to side, the low ceiling over the bunk pressing down on me so heavily that sometimes I woke convinced I was lying underneath the bed instead of on top of it. How was it possible to miss someone as much as I missed my mother? I missed her so much, I wanted to die. A hard, physical longing, like a craving for air underwater. Lying awake, I tried to recall all my best memories of her, to freeze her in my mind so I wouldn't forget her. But instead of birthdays and happy times, I kept remembering things like how a few days before she was killed, she'd stopped me halfway out the door to pick a thread off my school jacket. For some reason, it was one of the clearest memories I had of her. Her knitted eyebrows, the precise gesture of her reaching out to me, everything. Several times, too, drifting uneasily between dreaming and sleep. I sat up suddenly in bed at the sound of her voice speaking clearly in my head, remarks she might conceivably have made at some point but that I didn't actually remember. Things like, "Throw me an apple, would you?" And, "I wonder if this button's up the front or the back." And, "This sofa is in a terrible state of disreputableness." Light from the street flew in black bands across the floor. Hopelessly, I thought of my bedroom standing empty only a few blocks away, my own narrow bed with the worn red quilt, glow-in-the-dark stars from the planetarium, a picture postcard of James Whale's Frankenstein. The birds were back in the park again. The daffodils were up. This time of year, when the weather got nice, sometimes we woke up extra early in the mornings and walked through the park together instead of taking the bus to the west side. If only I could go back and change what had happened, keep it from happening somehow. Why hadn't I insisted we get breakfast instead of going to the museum? Why hadn't Mr. Beeman asked us to come in on Tuesday or Thursday? Either the second night after my mother died, or the third, sometime at any rate after Mrs. Barber took me to the doctor to get my headache seen to, the barbers were throwing a big party at the apartment that it was too late for them to cancel. There was whispering, a flurry of activity that I could scarcely take in.
"I think," said Mrs. Barber when she came back to Andy's room, "you and Theo might enjoy staying back here."
Despite her light tone, clearly it was not a suggestion, but an order.
"It'll be such a bore, and I really don't think you'll enjoy yourselves at all. I'll ask Etta to bring you a couple of plates from the kitchen."
Andy and I sat side by side on the lower bunk of his bed, eating cocktail shrimp and artichoke canapés from paper plates, or rather, he ate, while I sat with the plate on my knees, untouched. He had on a DVD, some action movie with exploding robots, showers of metal and flame. From the living room, clinking glasses, smells of candle wax and perfume, every now and then a voice rising brilliantly in laughter, the pianist's sparkling, up-tempo arrangement of "It's All Over Now, Baby Blue" seemed to be floating in from an alternate universe. Everything was lost. I had fallen off the map. The disorientation of being in the wrong apartment, with the wrong family, was wearing me down. So I felt groggy and punch drunk, weepy almost, like an interrogated prisoner prevented from sleeping for days. Over and over, I kept thinking, "I've got to go home." And then, for the millionth time, "I can't."
4. After 4 days, or maybe it was 5,
Andy loaded his books in his stretched-out backpack and returned to school. All that day, and the next, I sat in his room with his television turned to Turner Classic Movies, which was what my mother watched when she was home from work. They were showing movies adapted from Graham Greene, Ministry of Fear, The Human Factor, The Fallen Idol, This Gun for Hire. That second evening, while I was waiting for the third man to come on, Mrs. Barber, all Valentino'd up and on her way out the door to an event at the Frick, stopped by Andy's room and announced that I was going back to school the next day.
"Anybody would feel out of sorts," she said. "Back here by yourself? It isn't good for you."
I didn't know what to say. Sitting around on my own watching movies was the only thing I'd done since my mother's death that had felt even vaguely normal.
"It's high time for you to get back into some sort of a routine. Tomorrow." "I know it doesn't seem so, Theo," she said when I didn't answer. "But keeping busy is the only thing in the world that'll make you feel better."
Resolutely, I stared at the television. I hadn't been at school since the day before my mother died, and as long as I stayed away, her death seemed unofficial somehow. But once I went back, it would be a public fact. Worse, the thought of returning to any kind of normal routine seemed disloyal, wrong. It kept being a shock every time I remembered it, a fresh slap. She was gone. Every new event, everything I did for the rest of my life, would only separate us more and more. Days she was no longer a part of, an ever-growing distance between us. Every single day for the rest of my life, she would only be further away.
"Theo?"
Startled, I looked up at her.
"One foot after the other. There's no other way to get through this."
The next day, they were having a World War II spy marathon. Cairo, The Hidden Enemy, code name Emerald, that I really wanted to stay home and see. Instead, I dragged myself out of bed when Mr. Barber stuck his head in to wake us. "Up and at 'em, hoplites," and walked to the bus stop with Andy. It was a rainy day and cold enough that Mrs. Barber had forced me into wearing an embarrassing old duffel coat of plaits over my clothes. Andy's little sister Kitsy danced ahead of us in her pink raincoat, skipping through puddles and pretending she didn't know us. I knew it was going to be horrible, and it was, from the second I stepped into the bright hall and smelled the familiar old school smell, citrus disinfectant, and something like old socks. Hand-lettered signs in the hallway, sign-up sheets for tennis lab and cooking classes, tryouts for The Odd Couple, field trip to Ellis Island, and tickets still available for the Swing into Spring concert. Hard to believe that the world had ended, and yet somehow these ridiculous activities kept grinding on. The strange thing, the last day I'd been in the building, she was alive. I kept on thinking it, and every time it was new. Last time I opened this locker. Last time I touched this stupid fucking Insights in Biology book. Last time I saw Lindy Maisel putting on lip gloss with that plastic wand. It seemed hardly credible that I couldn't follow these moments back to a world where she wasn't dead.
"Sorry."
People I knew said it, and people who had never spoken to me in my life. Other people, laughing and talking in the hallways, fell silent when I walked by, throwing grave or quizzical looks my way. Others still ignored me completely, as playful dogs will ignore an ill or injured dog in their midst, by refusing to look at me, by romping and frolicking around me in the hallways as if I wasn't there. Tom Cable, in particular, avoided me as assiduously as if I were a girl he'd dumped. At lunch, he was nowhere to be found. In Spanish, he sauntered in well after class started, missing the awkward scene where everyone crowded somberly around my desk to say they were sorry. He didn't sit by me as usual, but up front, slouched down with his legs thrown out to the side. Rain drummed on the window panes as we translated our way through a series of bizarre sentences, sentences that would have done Salvador Dali proud, about lobsters and beach umbrellas, and Marisol with the long eyelashes taking the lime green taxi to school. After class, on the way out, I made a point of going up and saying hi as he was getting his books.
"Oh, hey, how's it going?"
he said, distanced, leaning back with a smart-ass arch to the brow. "I heard and all.
Yeah.
This was our routine, too cool for everyone else, always in on the same joke.
Tough luck. That really bites. Thanks. Hey, should have played sick. Told you. My mom blew up all over that shit, too. Hit the fucking ceiling.
Well, he said, half shrugging in the stunned moment that followed this, looking up, down, around, with a,
who, me,
look, like he'd thrown a snowball with a rock in it.
Anyway, so,
he said in a moving right along voice,
what's with the costume?
What?
Well,
ironic little backstep, eyeing the plaid duffel coat.
First place, definitely, in the Platt Barber look-alike contest.
And despite myself, it was a shock after days of horror and numbness, an eruptive Tourette's-like spasm. I laughed.
Excellent call, Cable,
I said, adopting Platt's hateful drawl. We were good mimics, both of us, and often conducted entire conversations in other people's voices. Dumb newscasters, whiny girls, wheedling and fatuous teachers.
Tomorrow, I'm coming dressed as you.
But Tom didn't reply in kind or pick up the thread. He'd lost interest.
Maybe not,
he said, with a half shrug, a little smirk.
Later. Right, later.
I was annoyed. What the fuck was his problem? Yet it was part of our ongoing dark comedy act, amusing only to us, to abuse and insult each other. And I was pretty sure he'd come find me after English, or that he'd catch up with me on the way home, running up behind me and bopping me on the head with his algebra workbook. But he didn't. The next morning before first period, he didn't even look at me when I said hi, and his blanked out expression as he shouldered past stopped me cold. Lindy Maisel and Mandy Quaife turned at their lockers to stare at each other, giggling in a half-shocked way.
Oh my God.
Next to me, my lab partner, Sam Weingarten, was shaking his head.
What a dick,
he said in a loud voice, so loud everybody in the hall turned.
You're a real dick, Cable, you know that?
But I didn't care. Or at least, I wasn't hurt or depressed. Instead, I was furious. My friendship with Tom had always had a wild, manic quality, something unhinged and hectic and a little perilous about it. And though all the same old high energy was still there, the current had reversed, voltage humming in the opposite direction, so that now instead of horsing around with him in study hall, I wanted to push his head in the urinal, yank his arm out of the socket, beat his face bloody on the sidewalk, make him eat dog shit and garbage off the curb. The more I thought about it, the more enraged I grew. So mad sometimes that I walked back and forth in the bathroom muttering to myself, if Cable hadn't fingered me to Mr. Beeman.
I know now, Theo, those cigarettes weren't yours.
If Cable hadn't got me suspended, if my mom hadn't taken the day off, if we hadn't been at the museum at exactly the wrong time. Well, even Mr. Beeman had apologized for it, sort of. Because, sure, there were issues with my grades and plenty of other stuff Mr. Beeman didn't know about. But the inciting incident, the thing that had got me called in, the whole business with the cigarettes in the courtyard. Whose fault was that? Cable's. It wasn't like I expected him to apologize. In fact, it wasn't like I would have said anything to him about it, ever. Only, now I was a pariah? Persona non grata? He wouldn't even talk to me? I was smaller than Cable, but not by a lot. And whenever he cracked wise in class, as he couldn't prevent himself from doing, or ran past me in the hall with his new best friends Billy Wagner and Thad Randolph, the way we'd once raced around together, always in overdrive, that urge to danger and craziness. All I could think was how much I wanted to beat the shit out of him. Girls laughing as he cowered from me in tears.
Ooh, Tom, boo-hoo-hoo, are you crying?
Doing my best to provoke a fight, I cracked him in the nose, accidentally, on purpose, by swinging the bathroom door in his face, and shoved him into the drinks dispenser so he dropped his disgusting cheese fries on the floor. But instead of jumping on me, as I longed for him to do, he only smirked and walked off without a word. Not everyone avoided me, of course. Lots of people put notes and gifts in my locker, including Isabella Cushing and Martina Lichtblau, the most popular girls in my year. And my old enemy Wynne Temple from fifth grade surprised me by coming up and giving me a bear hug. but most people responded to me with a cautious, half-terrified politeness. It wasn't as if I went around crying or even acting disturbed, but still they'd stop in the middle of their conversations if I sat down with them at lunch. Grown-ups, on the other hand, paid me an uncomfortable amount of attention. I was advised to keep a journal, talk with my friends, make a memory collage. Crackpot advice, as far as I was concerned. Other kids were uneasy around me no matter how normally I acted, and the last thing I wanted was to call attention to myself by sharing my feelings with people or doing therapeutic crafts in the arts room. I seemed to spend an inordinate amount of time standing in empty classrooms and offices, staring at the floor, nodding my head senselessly, with concerned teachers who asked me to stay after class or pulled me aside to talk. My English teacher, Mr. Neuspiel, after sitting on the side of his desk and delivering a tense account of his own mother's horrifying death at the hands of an incompetent surgeon, had patted me on the back and given me a blank notebook to write in. Mrs. Swanson, the school counselor, showed me a couple of breathing exercises and suggested that I might find it helpful to discharge my grief by going outside and throwing ice cubes against a tree. And even Mr. Borofsky, who taught math and was considerably less bright-eyed than most of the other teachers, took me aside out in the hall and, talking very quietly with his face about 2 inches away from mine, told me how guilty he'd felt after his brother had died in a car accident. Guilt came up a lot in these talks. Did my teachers believe, as I did, that I was guilty of causing my mother's death? Apparently so. Mr. Borofsky had felt so guilty for letting his brother drive home drunk from the party that night that he'd even thought for a brief while about killing himself. Maybe I'd thought about suicide too. But suicide wasn't the answer. I accepted all this counsel politely, with a glassy smile and a glaring sense of unreality. Many adults seemed to interpret this numbness as a positive sign. I remember particularly Mr. Beeman, an overly clipped Brit in a dumb tweed motoring cap, whom despite his solicitude I had come to hate irrationally as an agent of my mother's death, complimenting me on my maturity and informing me that I seemed to be coping awfully well. And maybe I was coping awfully well, I don't know. Certainly I wasn't howling aloud or punching my fist through windows or doing any of the things I imagined people might do who felt as I did. But sometimes, unexpectedly, grief pounded over me in waves that left me gasping. And when the waves washed back, I found myself looking out over a brackish wreck, which was illumined in a light so lucid, so heartsick and empty, that I could hardly remember that the world had ever been anything but dead. 5. Quite honestly, my Decker grandparents were the last thing on my mind, which was just as well, since social services was unable to run them down right away on the scanty information I was able to give them. Then Mrs. Barber knocked at the door of Andy's room and said,
"Theo, may we speak for a moment, please?"
Something in her manner spoke distinctly of bad news, though in my situation it was hard to imagine how things could be possibly worse. When we were seated in the living room, by a 3-foot-tall arrangement of pussy willow and blossoming apple branches fresh from the florist, she crossed her legs and said,
"I've had a call from the social services. They've contacted your grandparents. Unfortunately, it seems that your grandmother is unwell."
For a moment, I was confused.
"Dorothy? If that's what you call her, yes."
"Oh, she's not really my grandmother."
"I see,"
said Mrs. Barber, as if she didn't actually see and didn't want to.
"At any rate, it seems she's not well. A back ailment, I believe. And your grandfather is looking after her. So the thing is, you see, I'm sure they're very sorry, but they say it's not practical for you to be down there right now. Not to stay with them in their home, anyway,"
she added, when I didn't say anything.
"They've offered to pay for you to stay in a Holiday Inn near their house, for the time being. But that seems a bit impractical, doesn't it?"
There was an unpleasant buzzing in my ears. Sitting there under her level, ice-gray gaze, I felt for some reason terribly ashamed of myself. I had dreaded the thought of going to Grandpa Decker and Dorothy so much that I'd blocked them almost completely from my mind. But it was quite another thing to know they didn't want me. A flicker of sympathy passed over her face.
You mustn't feel bad about it, she said. And in any case, you mustn't worry. It's been settled that you'll stay with us for the next few weeks, and at the very least, finish your year at school. Everyone agrees that's best. By the way, she said, leaning closer, that's a lovely ring. Is that a family thing?
Yes, I said. For reasons I would have found hard to explain, I had taken to carrying the old man's ring around with me almost everywhere I went. Mostly I toyed around with it while it was in my jacket pocket, but every now and then I slipped it on my middle finger and wore it, even though it was too big and slid around a bit.
Interesting. Your mother's family? Or your father's?
My mother's, I said, after a slight pause, not liking the way the conversation was going.
May I see it?
I took it off and dropped it in her palm. She held it up to the lamp.
Lovely, she said. Carnelian. And this intaglio. Greco-Roman? Or a family crest?
Crest, I think. She examined the clawed, mythological beast.
It looks like a griffin. Or maybe a winged lion.
She turned it sideways into the light and looked into the inside of the ring.
And this engraving inside?
My expression of puzzlement made her frown.
Don't tell me you've never noticed it. Hang on.
She got up and went to the desk, which had lots of intricate drawers and cubbyholes, and returned with a magnifying glass.
This will be better than my reading glasses, she said,
peering through it.
Still, this old copper plate is hard to see.
She brought the magnifying glass close, then farther away.
Blackwell. Does that ring a bell?
In fact, it did. Something beyond words, but the thought had blown away and vanished before it fully materialized.
I see some Greek letters, too. Very interesting.
She dropped the ring back in my hand.
It's an old ring, she said. You can tell by the patina on the stone, and by the way it's worn down. See there? Americans used to pick up these classical intaglios in Europe, back in the Henry James days, and have them set as rings, souvenirs of the Grand Tour. If they don't want me, where am I going to go?
For a blink, Mrs. Barber looked taken aback. Almost immediately she recovered herself and said,
Well, I wouldn't worry about that now. It's probably best anyway for you to stay here a bit longer and finish out your year at school, don't you agree? Now,
she nodded,
be careful with that ring, and mind that you don't lose it. I can see how loose it is. You might want to put it someplace safe instead of wearing it around like that.
6. But I did wear it. Or, rather, I ignored her advice to put it in a safe place and continued to carry it around in my pocket. When I hefted it in my palm, it was very heavy. If I closed my fingers around it, the gold got warm from the heat of my hand, but the carved stone stayed cool. Its weighty, antiquated quality, its mixture of sobriety and brightness, were strangely comforting. If I fixed my attention on it intensely enough, it had a strange power to anchor me in my drifting state and shut out the world around me. But for all that, I really didn't want to think about where it had come from. Nor did I want to think about my future. For though I had scarcely been looking forward to a new life in rural Maryland, at the chill mercies of my Decker grandparents, I now began to seriously worry about what was going to happen to me. Everyone seemed profoundly shocked at the Holiday Inn idea, as if Grandpa Decker and Dorothy had suggested I move into a shed in their backyard. But to me it didn't seem so bad. I'd always wanted to live in a hotel. And even if the Holiday Inn wasn't the kind of hotel I'd imagined, certainly I would manage. Room service hamburgers, pay-per-view, a pool in summer. How bad could it be? Everyone, the social workers, Dave the shrink, Mrs. Barber, kept telling me again and again that I could not possibly live on my own at a Holiday Inn in suburban Maryland, that no matter what, it would never actually come to that, not seeming to realize that their supposedly comforting words were only increasing my anxiety 100-fold.
The thing to remember,
said Dave, the psychiatrist who had been assigned to me by the city,
is that you'll be taken care of, no matter what.
He was a 30-ish guy with dark clothes and trendy eyeglasses, who always looked as if he'd just come from a poetry reading in the basement of some church.
Because there are tons of people looking out for you, who only want what's best for you.
I had grown suspicious of strangers talking about what was best for me, as it was exactly what the social workers had said before the subject of the foster home came up. But I don't think my grandparents are so wrong, I said.
Wrong about what?
About the Holiday Inn. It might be an okay place for me to be.
Are you saying that things are not okay for you at your grandparents' home?
Said Dave, without missing a beat.
No! I hated this about him, how he was always putting words in my mouth. All right, then. Maybe we can phrase it another way.
He folded his hands and thought,
why would you rather live at a hotel than with your grandparents?
I didn't say that. He put his head to the side.
No, but from the way you keep bringing up the Holiday Inn, like it's a viable choice, I'm hearing you say that's what you prefer to do.
It seems a lot better than going into a foster home.
Yes,
he leaned forward.
But please hear me say this. You're only 13, and you just lost your primary caregiver. Living alone right now is really not an option for you. What I'm trying to say is that it's too bad your grandparents are dealing with these health issues. But believe me, I'm sure we can work out something much better once your grandmother is up and around.
I said nothing. Clearly he had never met Grandpa Decker and Dorothy. Though I hadn't been around them very much myself, the main thing I remembered was the complete absence of blood feeling between us. The opaque way they looked at me as if I was some random kid who'd wandered over from the mall. The prospect of going to live with them was almost literally unimaginable, and I'd been racking my brains, trying to remember what I could about my last visit to their house, which wasn't very much, as I'd only been 7 or 8 years old. There had been hand-stitched sayings framed and hanging on the walls, a plastic countertop contraption that Dorothy used to dehydrate foods in. At some point, after Grandpa Decker had yelled at me to keep my sticky little mitts off his train set, my dad had gone outside for a cigarette. It was winter, and not come back inside the house.
Jesus God,
my mother had said once we were out in the car. It had been her idea that I should get to know my father's family. And after that, we never went back. Several days after the Holiday Inn offer, a greeting card arrived for me at the barber's. An aside, is it wrong to think that Bob and Dorothy, as they signed themselves, should have picked up the telephone and called me? Or got in their car and driven to the city to see about me themselves? But they did neither of these things. Not that I exactly expected them to rush to my side with wails of sympathy, but still, it would have been nice if they'd surprised me with some small, if uncharacteristic, gesture of affection. Actually, the card was from Dorothy. The Bob, plainly in her hand, had been squeezed in alongside her own signature as an afterthought. The envelope, interestingly, had the look of having been steamed open and resealed. By Mrs. Barber? Social services? Although the card itself was definitely in Dorothy's stiff up-and-down European handwriting that appeared exactly once a year on our Christmas cards, writing that, as my father had once commented, looked as if it ought to be on the chalkboard at La Goulou, listing the daily fish specials. On the front of the card was a drooping tulip, and underneath, a printed slogan, "There are no endings." Dorothy, from the very little I remembered of her, was not one to waste words, and this card was no exception. After a perfectly cordial opening, sorry for my tragic loss, thinking of me in this time of sorrow, she offered to send me a bus ticket to Woodbriar, Maryland, while simultaneously alluding to vague medical conditions that made it difficult for her and Grandpa Decker to meet the demands for my care.
Demands? Said Andy. She makes it sound as if you're asking for $10 million in unmarked notes.
I was silent. Oddly, it was the picture on the greeting card that had troubled me.
It was the kind of thing you'd see in a drugstore card rack. Perfectly normal, but still a photograph of a wilted flower, no matter how artistically done. Didn't seem quite the thing to send to somebody whose mother had just died.
I thought she was supposed to be so sick. Why is she the one writing?
Search me. I had wondered the same thing. It did seem weird that my actual grandfather hadn't included a message or even bothered to sign his own name.
Maybe,
said Andy gloomily.
Your grandfather has Alzheimer's, and she's holding him prisoner in his own home to get his money. That happens quite frequently with the younger wives, you know.
I don't think he has that much money.
Possibly not, said Andy, clearing his throat ostentatiously. But one can never rule out the thirst for power. Nature red in tooth and claw.
Perhaps she doesn't want you edging in on the inheritance.
Chum,
said Andy's father, looking up rather suddenly from the Financial Times. I don't think this is a terribly productive line of conversation.
Well, quite honestly, I don't see why Theo can't stay on with us,
said Andy, voicing my own thoughts.
I enjoy the company, and there's plenty of space in my room.
Well, certainly we'd all like to keep him for ourselves,
said Mr. Barber, with a heartiness not as full or convincing as I would have liked.
But what would his family think? The last I heard, kidnapping was still against the law.
Well, I mean, Daddy, that hardly seems to be the situation here,
said Andy in his irritating, faraway voice. Abruptly, Mr. Barber got up with his club soda in his hand. He wasn't allowed to drink because of the medicine he took.
Theo, I forget. Do you know how to sail?
It took me a moment to realize what he'd asked me.
No? Oh, that's too bad. Andy had the most outstanding time at his sailing camp up in Maine last year, didn't you?
Andy was silent. He had told me many times that it was the worst 2 weeks of his life.
Do you know how to read nautical flags?
Mr. Barber asked me.
Sorry,
I said.
There's an excellent chart in my study. I'd be happy to show you.
Don't make that face, Andy. It's a perfectly handy skill for any boy to know.
Certainly it is, if he needs to hail a passing tugboat.
These smart remarks of yours are very tiresome,
said Mr. Barber, although he looked more distracted than annoyed.
Besides, he said, turning to me, I think you'd be surprised how often nautical flags pop up in parades and movies and, I don't know, on the stage.
Andy pulled a face.
The stage,
he said derisively. Mr. Barber turned to look at him.
Yes, the stage. Do you find the term amusing?
Pompous is a lot more like it.
Well, I'm afraid I fail to see what you find so pompous about it. Certainly it's the very word your great-grandmother would have used.
Mr. Barber's grandfather had been dropped from the social register for marrying Olga Osgood, a minor movie actress.
My point exactly.
Then what would you have me call it?
Actually, Daddy, what I would really like to know is the last time you saw nautical flags showcased in any theatrical production.
South Pacific, said Mr. Barber swiftly.
Besides South Pacific.
I rest my case.
I don't believe you and Mother even saw South Pacific.
For God's sake, Andy.
Well, even if you did, one example doesn't sufficiently establish your case.
I refuse to continue this absurd conversation. Come along, Theo.
7. From this point on, I began trying especially hard to be a good guest, to make my bed in the mornings, to always say thank you and please, and to do everything I knew my mother would want me to do. Unfortunately, the Barbers didn't exactly have the kind of household where you could show your appreciation by babysitting the younger siblings or pitching in with the dishes. Between the woman who came to look after the plants, a depressing job since there was so little light in the apartment the plants mostly died, and Mrs. Barber's assistant, whose main job seemed to be rearranging the closets or the china collection, they had somewhere in the neighborhood of 8
people working for them. When I'd asked Mrs. Barber where the washing machine was, she'd looked at me as if I'd asked for lye and lard to boil up for soap. But though nothing was required of me,